Dove va poi questa cosa qua? Qua. Non ci sono già, perfetto. Ok, so, well, that's interesting. It's kind of fun. Okay. So you have listened for a couple of weeks about model-based design on one side, which is a very important design methodology that has been introduced about 10 years ago, 10, 15 years ago, and now is the way in which most of the embedded system companies are going towards. Not all of them, but especially in the transportation sector, so automotive and airplane, they do model-based design, most of them. Now, model-based design requires that you have a good tool to enter the design itself, so that you have a language that is capable of representing what you want to do. And so in the case of industrial domains, most of the companies that use model-based design use MathWorks, right? So use Simulink and or state chat. State flow, okay? there are so many. Did you present the paper on many different dialects of states, right? So it's, there are the state charts was the original version of the approach, which introduced a non-determinate hierarchy and what was the third one? And hierarchy, non-determinate. There are three points. Well, in any case, the two important ones are hierarchy and non-determinism. And so because of the of the fact that the original specification left something open, then there were many different ways in which people implemented that specification. So that's the reason why you have all these state chart-based descriptions. So in fact, if you take state chart, the original state chart, you plug in the description of that tool into state flow, then it doesn't work. Okay? Or there is another program called StateMate. So mostly works. Okay, shouldn't say it doesn't work. But there are some cases in which you get different results. So you simulate in one domain, simulate in the other domain, you get two different results. And the reason is because there are these features that can be interpreted one way or another way. So in any case, so people do that, and then it's easier to simulate, it's easy to understand what the heck is going on, and when you're satisfied with that level of the design, you hope that by pressing a button you get the implementation, which is what these tools do, and there are two tools that are very much used for this task. One is, of course, a real-time workshop by MathWorks, and the other one actually is more used, is called TargetLink. It is built by a company called DSpace. The interesting thing is that they start from Simulink and Stateflow. So the input is the same. And so and in fact, TargetLink was actually proposed before real-time workshop. So synthesis of code from models was done by not MathWorks, but another company. And this company is a German company, actually, which is especially famous in automotive, but by now they expanded everywhere. So that's a story about model-based design. Now, of course, you have to be careful about what the translation does, and you have to make sure that the code generated is actually doing the same thing as your original model. Otherwise, you verify it on the original model, you get that the implementation doesn't do the same thing, it's after search, right? And so then there is also the verification problem or the problem of certifying the compiler, quote unquote, or the code optimizer. Now, you may hear people talking about code generation and other people talk about software synthesis. Actually, there was a conference last week, it's ES Week, right? Embedded System Week, and there was a special workshop which was dedicated to software synthesis. Now then you may ask, well, what is the difference between software synthesis and code generation? And actually many people use it interchangeably, but there is a difference. Okay, and at least to me. And in fact, I was supposed to give a talk in that workshop when problem happened. I didn't go, but I can tell you what it is. Okay, so you are privileged because you know it's the first people who hear about it. But if you look at synthesis, right? What is the idea? The idea is that you actually take the original design, right? The, for example, the MathWorks representation of data flow or a state machine. And then you optimize. So what you want to get out of the transformation is code which is highly optimized. So now you can do two things. One is you keep the original description fixed. You don't change it at all. And then you just try to take that particular structure of the design. You try to do a very good job at producing code. Right? That's code generation. Right? So generate code from the model. Now, synthesis has intrinsic in it, at least in my interpretation of the word, the fact that you push optimization to the limit. Right? So by looking at what was done, for example, in hardware, when we developed things like MIPS and so on, what we did is that we decomposed optimization into two parts. One was take the description, a mathematical description of the problem, and manipulate it. Right? And then after you massage it and you reduce it, you hammer it and so on and so forth, then you generate the thing. Okay? So synthesis implies that you also change the original description of the problem. So you optimize even the original description of the problem. Okay? So that's the difference. So the final result of optimization, in principle, should be better than what you get out of code generation, right? How many tools do that? Zero. None. Okay, so it's opportunity, okay, for getting something out of it. But that's what we think is code synthesis. And in fact, we will look at one particular approach that we followed many years ago to do code synthesis. And actually, you will see that we manipulate the mathematical description of the system that you want to optimize. Okay, so that's model-based design, code generation, all that. By the way, when you do code generation, the problem remains when you have to produce tasks, right? And you have to coordinate tasks. You have also seen, after the model-based generation, the lectures on real-time operating systems. And we know that real-time operating systems offer an interface or a service, set of services for the software to use the hardware resources that are in your ECU or your board and so on. Okay? Now, it so happens that the resources as usual are limited. So if you try to press through a thing that is too big through a container that's too small, it doesn't work. Right? So what you need to do is to chop it up, right? To make it smaller. And so then the idea came by that in order to exploit at best your platform, your architectural platform, is to decompose the various tasks in software in pieces. And then these pieces would be using the resources of the computer at best, right? Because they are smaller, they can be more flexible, you can think sequentialize them, you can parallelize them, you can do all kinds of tricks and so on, right? Now, what happens when you have this particular piece of code, this other particular piece of code, and then you need to mix them, we know that since the operating system looks at what is available, right, to be executed. So here I am as a microprocessor, so all of a sudden a resource is free. And so I have to say who goes, right? Who uses that resource? So it looks up and say, okay, who's ready? Then he is ready, he is ready. Now, which one do I pick? Right? So then there is the use of priorities, right? So that particular combination of various tasks and so on and so forth through priorities and other glue methodologies is what in general is done by hand, not done automatically. So because the designer knows best if he's more important than he is, right? then there are two different ways of doing, of letting two people share the resource and let one guy to get hold of a resource. One is that once the guy has a resource, you cannot get it up. Right? Like when you go to the airplane, like yesterday, right? Once the toilet is occupied, there's no way, right, that you can kick out the guy. So that's one way of doing the resource. The other one is that you can preempt, okay, the guy is using if you have a higher priority. So if you have a line that has to go through the luggage control, and then there's one guy is losing the plane, or he has a big car, you know, the black car, the gold car, whatever, he gets priority. So what happens is it goes in front, right? The other guys mumble, have to wait, right? So that's what the operating system does, handles this priority, so allocates the various pieces to what they are supposed to do. Now, then there are all kinds of algorithms, because suppose that there are too many people with the black card or the gold card or whatever, so a poor guy here from Denmark has got no cards, right? So he may never get through, right? It's possible, right? It is definitely possible. So now, how do you guarantee that he eventually gets through and gets to his place, right? In principle, there's no guarantee, right? Because, again, if there are too many people with the car, then the poor guy doesn't have the car, gets stuck, right? That's called fairness, okay? So, of the scheduling policy. On the other hand, there may be one guy who really needs to get to the plane because the plane is late. And so if you then let him go through, you will have an error, right? And so that's the reason why you need priorities and the like, because there are some guys that have more urgency to get their things done than others, okay? And so that is the priority-based scheduling. And you can have preemption or non-preemptive schedule. So a non-preemptive schedule is, as we said before, until he is through, I cannot go past him. But I can go before him if he is after him and he's not using the resource of the computer, right? That's non-preemptive, okay? And preemption is when you stop the guy. Now, when you stop the guy, you can have two or three different things. One is you just to kill it, right? Go away. Mm-hmm. The other one is that you suspend the execution, okay? Suspend the execution means that he stores his own state. And you say, okay, I was here, right? Wait. Then the guy goes through, and then he starts where he left off, right? So that's one way. And the other way is just start from scratch all over again. Now, there are some interesting phenomena that I'm sure that Mark has talked to you about, is when you have priority inversion. So which happens that the guy with less priority goes before the big guy because of the way in which the algorithms work, right? And so that's called priority inversion. And I know that he has presented you the case of the Mars lander that kept on rebooting on Mars, and so the thing kind of eventually crashed to the end. So that is because there was a bug on the priority allocation of the various tasks. And that is several million dollars of pain, right? So no good. So that's what we have done before. Now, if you look at model-based design, is a methodology that goes from the functionality and generates code, and code is an implementation. Right? And so what you see there is a mapping from the functionality onto an architecture. So code generation applied to model-based design does that. Now, if I tell you, okay, I give you an operating system. Now, what is an operating system? Is a piece of functionality or a piece of architecture? Is what? What would you say it is? Any idea? How would you look at an operating system? Thinking along the line of what we have done in class so far. Any idea? So in some sense, if you put the scheduling algorithm in the operating system, then it becomes mapping. So the actual scheduling algorithm does the mapping, because you've got the functionality, You got the architecture here, and that kind of. The other one, as you said, suppose that we have no scheduling, so throw away the scheduling stuff, right? Then the operating system is simply providing interfaces of the hardware that is in the platform, right? So in which case, it's part of the architecture, right? Per se, it doesn't do anything. It stays there, right? So unless you tell it what to do, the operating system and does nothing, which is typical of architecture. If architecture don't put anything in it, doesn't do anything. Okay? So that's the reason why, in some sense, the operating system should be considered for the part without the presentation of the hardware, should be considered as architecture. While the scheduling algorithm is a method. Okay? Because it takes functionality and plugs it down onto that. Now, in the discussion that we had about, you know, for example, preemption and things that go in parallel or sequential and so on and so forth, there is one big point, which is how the various tasks interact, right? Which means how the various subroutines talk to each other, if you like, right? Now, what does that mean? That is communication. So we are two separate objects, and we need to inform the other guy what I've done, right? So you have to deliver the information that this other guy needs. Now, that information, we know that there are two essential ways in which you can do that communication in software, right? One is going through a memory location, so the guy who's supposed to communicate with you, well, here, writes on the blackboard, then he will read on the blackboard, right? The other way is that by share variable. Now, how the heck am I doing? So, which means that in some sense, my brain communicates to his brain directly, right? Okay. So now that is dangerous. And it is indeed dangerous because I may think about something horrible and then all of a sudden I say something else and, you know, and he gets, what the heck is trying to tell me, right? And that's exactly what a program does, you know. It does intermediate calculation. And who knows what the heck they are. And so you may give information which is garbage because it's not the information it's supposed to give. So anything you do and you pass by share variables is bad programming practice, right? Never do that. Let's say in modern software engineering, you never do that. You write here, the guy picks up and reads here. Now, why do people don't do that in embedded software design? Any wild idea?
Why they don't use memory.
No, they love to do share variables.
One,
and second, doesn't use memory, so less memory, less expensive, right? Bad! Bad! Because 90% of the errors that you find in embedded software is because of that. Right? Because you have invalid data, you know, it comes back. And so then there are some strong input to the guys who are doing these things, and don't do that, right? So in which comes, yes?
Well, so this one, can you say you have invalid input or invalid data and you share memory?
Not share memory, share variables. Share variables means that you don't write to memory and you don't read from memory. You write directly onto the process, right? So into its private memory, if you like, right? So there is no third places where you can make sure that the data is valid so the guy can read valid data. So what happens is that you get, you receive data as they are produced. It's like a synchronous design, right? So you're always connected. Yeah, you're sharing that variable, right?
Okay.
So you're not sharing the memory location, you're sharing the variable. So whatever that variable does, you see it.
How is that implemented though?
Like
I would thought that you just map a page of physical memory into both addresses.
Right.
And then you're sharing that page of memory and all the data on it.
Well, when you do share variable, it means that, for example, I work on variable X, right? And you have that same variable in your body, right?
Okay.
And so whatever this variable does, you see that.
Mm.
And so if you are ready to take calculation, look at it, oh, it's 5. But this guy is still writing to it. So it was an invalid value. But since you don't see it's invalid because it's the same variable, you see it all the time. Right? Yeah. So the same thing is when you have, for example, in hardware, it's the same thing when you don't have the buffer, right? When you don't have the clock, right? Because then what happens, say, okay, I'm ready to do, and you look at it, and you compute, and by the way, this is not settled.
Right.
And so I do computation based on, well, this is called race condition.
Right, so it'd be like a synchronization error then?
Yeah, if you like. Okay. I mean, it's more than, say, it's just an error, right?
Right.
Because you get data that is not valid.
Right.
Okay. And this is the, you know, like in hardware, same in software, there's no difference, right? And that's my point that I keep on saying. The difference is a basic fundamental issue that you communicate by sharing variables, right? In the case of hardware, it's an electrical signal, right? So you see it all the time. You just don't. If you add this buffer, you see it only at some point in time, and so you look at it and you know that that is right. So you have some kind of semaphore or synchronization mechanism, right? And that's the reason why synchronous design is good, right? It tells you, now you can go and look at it.
Okay.
Right? Now it's ready to look at it. Right? It's as if, I mean, again, suppose that you play soccer and then you don't warm up, then you get killed, right? I mean, your legs kind of, right? For people who are European. Okay, so there you go. Okay, so that's the... But embedded system, as you said, it's for performance reasons for this and that. But if you look at object-oriented programming, the only thing that object-oriented programming does, really, and besides, you know, the hierarchy, the class inheritance and all that, but it's saying thou shall communicate through memory locations, a synchronization kind of mechanism. So you're not allowed to share variables. Okay, and that's object orientation.
Right.
Okay, and just said in a very... So, which brings to the point that communication is key to ensure correctness, right? And so, let's look then at what it means to communicate. By the way, if you have your car, and sometimes you do get glitches of all kinds and types, and the car doesn't work correctly, and so on, 9 times out of 10 is a communication error. Something that gets corrupted or it's not communicated correctly, you know, right? Okay, so communication based data. Again, the key point about communication based design is that what you would like to do is that you would like to reduce the verification of the entire system to verification of the path. And then you would like that the interface between the paths of the communication is correct by construction. So again, current situation is unacceptable, interfaces are not specified clearly, there is no clear specification, and tools to create debug and so on, the interfaces don't exist. Okay. Now this is really annoying. So maybe we did something by switching on and off the thing. Okay, so what we need to do is to identify precisely and formally the concept of communication, and also the various level of abstraction, right? So because, after all, I can have a communication at the functional level where I communicate, I mean, my finite state machine communicates with your finite state machine. Nothing prevents that these two finite state machines be implemented on the same processor, by the way. So communication is between functional units, right? By the same token, I can have a single finite state machine that's too big to stay in one unit, and I break it up. In which case, then, there is communication at the implementation, which was not shown at the functional level, right? So don't think that the pattern of communication that you have at functional level is preserved into the implementation, okay? It can be very different, okay? So that's the reason why you need to worry about the level of abstraction. Okay, now, the other thing is that communication is also when you have a finite state machine that wants to talk to another model of computation, say for example a data flow, right? Data flow is asynchronous, finite state machine is synchronous. So what does it mean? You know, what if I am a finite state machine, what is the output that I should react to from the data flow? And what does it mean for a data flow to start computing if I'm getting output from an infinite statement? So that is a ratio of heterogeneous combination. So what we would like to do is to potentially, and that's a very interesting thing because it is a design principle. So any time that you have various objects that communicate among themselves, you should always do this exercise. Meaning, what do I want to tell the other person? How do I want to say it? Is the other person or the other component and be able to understand what I'm saying? What are the reactions to my actions? Okay, so that's what communication based design is all about. Now, by the way, if you look at the world of communication theory, right, we know that there is a large body of discussion about protocols, right? And so protocols regulate the way in which you exchange information. Right? So, and in general, the protocols, if you design correctly a protocol, is you do a great job in simplifying the design process. So, for example, when you have the specification of a particular communication infrastructure, take a bus, right? A bus. So that can be a large bus, right, on a car, like a CAN bus. Or it can be a bus on a chip, like the PI bus, or on the printed circuit bus. Now, what are these buses characterized by? These buses are characterized by the way in which they behave, and the way in which you want, and the way in which you should interface to it. Right? Now, since the bus is a single resource, you also have to provide what? In addition to the actual behavior of the bus. Scheduling, arbitration. It's called arbitration. So the way in which you arbitrate the access to the bus, okay? Scheduling. So which is exactly the same problem as we saw in software, right? And but it's the same as having access to that particular communication thing. Now, the arbitration is a protocol, right? So if you find the bus busy, what do? Right? You stay there, you throw it away, you forget about the data, you store it in a buffer, right? So that is a protocol. So again, formal synthesis of protocols is a very interesting topic. There has been work in it, but also there is also another piece of work which is very important, is verifying protocols. So for example, if I have a bus protocol, an arbitration protocol, then I would like to be able to say this arbitration has the following property. So for example, if I want to write to this bus, I will eventually be able to do it, and that I will, every time I use the bus, I don't screw up some other guy who had the data on that bus and get lost, right? So now that is not given, right? So I don't know how many of you have seen a specification of the bus protocol. The PI bus is about this much. And it's all in English. Or diagrams. This goes up, and then this goes down, this goes this way, this goes that way, right? So, now, interesting job. A few years ago, in GSRC, we had this group that said, okay, let's do formal verification of protocol. So they pick up the PI specification. After 20 pages, they gave up out of 2,000 pages, more or less. But in these 20 pages, they found 15 inconsistencies. So, just that you want to say one thing, and in page 10, you say the opposite. Right? That's not so very good. So how come that we can then build computers that work, right? And we have buses and... You know, because people take shortcuts, so they don't implement the standard, right? And that's the reason why when they say plug and play, yeah. So if you have a particular device to plug it in, sometimes the computer crashes, not any longer. But why not any longer? Because people got more and more and more experience about what to do and what not to do when you plug in a device, but not because there is a theory behind it, right? Will be nice to have a nice theory so that these turkeys that design these then protocols can be trusted, right? So that you don't waste a lot of time. So that's here it goes. So verification, right? We're separating computation and communication. Why do we make all this mess about, you know, be careful about what it is that you want to do when you communicate and what it is what you want to do when you communicate. Now, that orthogonalization is very important because if you separate the two aspects, as we know, like function and architecture, you can do many beautiful things because you simplify the process, right? And then you give Caesar what is Caesar's, right? So which means that if you are capable of separating these two functions, then you can indeed verify communication separately from verification, and there is a bug there, you know that the bug is there. If you don't do that, and you find, oh, by the way, this thing doesn't work, fine, but who is the culprit of this? Is this module, this module, is the bus? Separate, you know what it is. Okay. Then, of course, reuse is very important, because if you orthogonalize communication and computation, then you know that if I'm a block, and that is communication interface, then if I change the bus, and I have a new bus, then at most, I need to adjust my communication interface, and everything else stays the same. Now, interesting point. I was at ST, and I was looking at a particular component, architectural component that we're designing, which was a DSP, right? It was a processor. It was doing digital signal processor. Well, they wanted to reuse the same in five different designs, same object, same DSP. Right? Guess what? If you take this DSP from this environment and put it in there, you think it works? No. And you know why? Because inside the DSP itself, while you were doing implementation of what the DSP operation were, you took advantage of the fact that you were connected to a particular module. So now, if you take this module away and you plug it into that module, do you think this will work? Of course not. Now, these circuits had not taken advantage of the fact that they were connected to this. Maybe they would have wasted some, but they could have reused it here. And so they had to do five times redesign for the same thing. Right? So, horrible. All right. Then, of course, this for reuse, and then architectural exploration is, again, if you have abstract communication, you can say, well, what if I use this particular way of communicating rather than the other? What if I use LTTA versus synchronous communication? What if I use fully asynchronous, and so on? So you can ask all of these questions and decide then what is best instead of deciding it a priori. So what is communication, after all? Right? So let's go to the bottom line of all of this. And this is very simple, but is illustrates what's going on. So you got two blocks, S and R. S is an input and a set of input, set of output, and it performs a function between the input and the output. Same thing for this guy. Now, if you consider them in isolation, they have a particular behavior, fine. Now, when you make the two communicate, for example, you connect the output of this guy to the input of this guy, right? Then what happens to this guy here? Does it have the same behavior as before or not? Behavior means pairs of input and outputs, right? So does it or doesn't? What is changing, right? In this picture where nothing is connected to the next one which is connected to? Well, even independent of the algorithm itself. So what happens is that this was a free variable, right? So suppose that this object was defined to be, I don't know, a multiplication. So the output is y equals to x squared, where x is a real, a set of real, right? And so it can, you know, you can put x equal to 1, minus 1, 5, 22, 35, right? And so the output, the pairs of input and output are all the reals, right? Now, suppose that this guy can only put out integer, right? So what is then the behavior of R when it's connected to this guy? Can it generate 1.235? Cannot, because the input is only integer. So it can only produce, if the input is 1, produce 1. If the input is 2, produce 4. If the input is 3, produce 9. But it cannot produce 2.5. Why? Because the guy S cannot produce anything which is between 1 and 2. So the behavior of R when it's connected to S is limited, right? Because it's connected to this guy, it has less freedom. So in some sense, communication, every time you put things connected together, you reduce the freedom of this guy. It's always a restriction of the behavior of the component. Right, of course. S, in principle, doesn't have any restriction. Except, suppose the reverse. And so that R can only take integer. Right? And S is takes values on the real, right? Now all of a sudden, then S produces a value 2.5. Now what does R do when it sees 2.5? Blah. He doesn't know what to do with it because it's outside his domain, right? And so the connection, unless you restrict the input to S, is incorrect, right? It doesn't mean anything. You see that heterogeneity that I was talking about, what it does? Now, you can put an adapter. What kind of adapter could you put from the between the output of OS and IR? Such a way that IR can always compute. One thing is that you throw away. Right? You drop 2.5 or you truncate it, right? So 2.5, 2. Okay? And that is an adapter. So it's something that takes something that is not good for this guy and makes it good. Now think about when you plug in, you know, we are so bad, right? So we have, in all countries, the damn plug of electricity is all different, right? If you have, in Europe, you have these nice round things, and here you have this kind of rectangular stuff. But did you ever go to England? In England, the plugs are like this, you know. So you have to take a carriage to bring the plug. You know. Why do they do that? It's me, not only, but the plug. I mean, the size of the thing is like this. The prong is like this, right? And so when you do to England, what do you use? An adapter. And what you do is that you convert your nice and small plug into a monster, right? That's what we do. It's communication, right? So we have the standard in England, the standard in the United States. We need to make them communicate. And so that's the adapter. Right? The adapter takes these nice things and pulls out the monster. Right? Okay, same thing. Okay, so here we go. So the connection, you connect. So the connection C enables the interaction between the behavior S and R. Now, when we did the tag signal model, what is the connection? What is the meaning of the connection? It's saying this variable equal to that. Right? That's it. The connection process, remember that we say that connection is a process. The only job of a connection is to say this is equal to that. End of story. Okay? This is all it does, right? Is establishing equality between two values. And we say what may happen, right? So that's the ideal connection. But because of a problem that we said before. This poor guy spits out real, this guy doesn't understand the real, doesn't understand only the integer. And so what happens is that we have to adapt the two, and so we have these two additional things that we put on the two balls, right, that do that. Now, what we did here is to say this is the input space, this is the output space. Now the input space to R is the output space of S, and if we assume that the input space of R was identical to the one of S, you see immediately that the input space now is restricted. So every time you communicate, you restrict the behavior of the block. There is no other way out. So this is the case where R is not defined for some outputs of S, and so there is a behavior mismatch. So this is a real, it's an integer, what do I do? Okay? And that's where we need the adapter. Ta-ta, here it is. So the behavior adapter maps the output of S into the input of R. So in the case of the integer and real, take the real, truncates them, or rounds them, and produces integer, so that the R can work correctly. And so now you can imagine that this adapter is made of two parts. One is the output adapter of this guy, and which is Z prime, and Z double prime is the adapter of this guy. Now this may occur in certain particular conditions where neither of the two can be converted, right? So how do I make this with numbers? Well, suppose that this guy here can only take negative integers, right? So not only integers, but negative integers. So what you need from this guy, the adaptation, is that every time he sees a positive number, he flips it. Puts a minus on top of it, right? So that you can say Z double prime. And Z prime is whatever truncates or rounds. Right? So you can take the two and put them apart, or you can have a single block. Either way, I mean, it's not so difficult. Okay. So now this Z prime and Z double prime, then you can imagine that they encapsulate the behavior of S and S prime. So they make them talk to each other, or talk to the rest of the world, or be nice and be capable of doing things. So for example, remember when we were talking about the protocols in latency insensitive protocols? Well, we needed to have a particular property of the block that made up the circuit, that is the capability of doing nothing. So sitting there doing nothing. Now some of the objects or blocks may not have that, so they keep on doing something, right? But you want to stall them. And why do you want to store them? Because certain inputs should not be considered. Remember that we have this stuttering kind of situation in latency insensitive protocols, in which you have certain inputs that come to a block that means nothing, because we are adjusting, right? So there is a progression, right? After that everything was fine, but there is a period in which the data are meaningless. And so I should be able to see that situation and do nothing. So don't react to that, because otherwise you generate outputs which are different from what you had before. So the latency intensity problem will not be correct. So that particular case, there will be a wrapper around this guy that is making sure that when some particular input come in, the block stalls. Doesn't do anything. Now, suppose now that we have a physical channel here. So not only that, the connection is a way of saying that the output of one is equal to the input of the other guy. But there is something in between that does things, a channel, a physical channel. Now, a physical channel per se is another process, we know that, right? Because remember that the connection is always saying y equal to x, that's it, right? So if you want to model what the channel does, for example, a wireless channel, right? Now we know that a wireless channel may be noisy, may be so noisy that data doesn't go through. I mean, cell phone, drop the call, right? because the sun has decided that it's going to spit out more radiation. You know, it's unpredictable, right? So there are things that the channel does that are typical of the channel itself. So actually, again, invalid channels may introduce mismatch due to their physical properties, noise, interference, and so on. So this guy can make bad stuff happen. So what would you do then if you have a process in there that is an approximation of y equal to x? Because you would like to have y equal to x, but actually you don't have y equal to x, you may have y equal to x plus minus delta, which means there is a delay. You can have y equal to x prime, where x prime is a distortion of x, and so on. Now, if you want to make sure that you recover the original thing, you got to adapt the channel as well. Right? And so, in fact, in most of the communication mechanisms that we know, there are protocols that adjust the results as they come in. Error correcting code, for example, right? You have a way of saying, gee, this data has been corrupted, and I know what the original data is. I can recover it. And so what you do is that you have a particular function that takes place that adjusts for a physical sense. So what it means is that there is indeed a mismatch with respect to what it's supposed to be, right? So the output of this guy is not what this guy is expecting. And now what I would like to do is that I would like to encapsulate C now, right? I would like to be able to eliminate the behavior of C. Here it is. So I can put in a adapter before the physical channel and after the physical channel. So error correcting code, encoding and decoding, that's what it does. Well, it can be also both ways, right? And right now we are just seeing one way, okay? But there is no... I mean, if you have two ways, you can either split them or you can have two ways adaptation, right? So either way. And so, in fact, I do know of cases in which you have different adaptation if it comes this way and goes that way, right? So again, then you have to choose the adapter as C and CR in such a way that C prime is as close as possible to the identity. That is what we wanted in the first place. Because the idea of communication is that you want the equality to be true. And the point is that it's not true, so we have to adjust it so that it becomes the identity. So we have a behavior adapter with nothing to do with the physical connection. It's to do with the input and output spaces. And we need to make them consistent, because otherwise the connection will not make sense. And then we need the behavior adapters. Now, these adapters are to adjust for the physical characteristic of the interconnection. So they're very different mechanisms, right? They're two different things. So in this case, we need a behavior adapter that takes into consideration this channel here, and which is a different kind of behavior adapter as we've seen before. So let's look at FIFO, and let's consider them as behavior adapters. So FIFO are cues, right? And first in, first out is a way of telling where the process R reads the data. Now, why do we may need this this adaptation here with the FIFO cue? It's because, for example, S goes faster than R. And so it keeps on producing data, and R is not ready to do something in it, right? So this one is a behavior mismatch, right? Because one goes fast and the other one goes slow, right? And so what we do is that in order to make sure that the guy who's receiving the signal behaves correctly, we need to store the data so that it can receive them in the correct order and doesn't drop anything, okay? So that's the reason why a FIFO is really indeed a an adapter and an unbounded FIFO, so infinite number of locations in the buffer, is an ideal adapter because it doesn't matter how fast the process S is, then I will never produce an output from R which is incorrect. It's always going to be correct, no matter how fast S is. Now, of course, it's not in this world. So, we may have situation in which we need a protocol that does what? And so, suppose that you have three buffers here, but this guy is four times as fast as R. So, at some point, it will accumulate things. And so, you either overwrite one data, but that's not good, right? Because if it overwrites one data, you don't produce stream equivalents. So, that's not good, right? So what else can you do? Well, remember what I said, that you have to have, sometimes you have to adapt the behavior of the component to be capable of doing nothing, right? Sitting there idle, right? And so what I need to have is a mechanism that when the FIFO is full, tells S, stop it, right? I cannot process. So S will skip a computation, we'll just look at the moon, waiting for the FIFO to be ready to go. Now, this implies that I have to have a communication in reverse, right? So I'm communicating between here and here, but I need information. So I need something that comes back. This kind of handshaking protocol. Handshaking means I say something, it tells me something back. So it's both ways, right? As you said before, there is one way and both ways. Handshaking protocols are both ways. We have to agree on the fact that everything is okay. So now this situation of S, of the FIFO, which is full, and is telling the guy who's putting in the data, look, I'm full, don't do anything, is called back pressure. So it's pressing back the guy who's sending to say, don't do anything. So I'm pressuring him back and say, don't push too much. So again, bounded FIFOs is to prevent overflow. You restrict, let me look at, restrict S using blocking write, right? Blocking write means stop it, right? It's this request of knowledge and shaking or back pressure is all the same thing, right? So same issue. So I'm really very sorry. I can't even read myself here. I have to read on my computer. Okay. So the protocol design is in some sense a way of accommodating for all these things. So ideal connection is one line. Then I must put in behavior adaptation. That is because the two may talk different languages, real versus integer. Now I take care of that with these two blocks that adapt S and R. But now is the channel. Now the channel should have this property of being an identity, but it is not. The channel is not an identity. So then I need to have another pair of adapters that make it an identity seen here. Right. At this point, they are as close to an identity as possible. And then the last thing, I may have a last adaptation that is needed to adjust for speed of transmission. So now, right now, what you have then is 1, 2, 3 skins of each of the blocks, and each of these skins, the algorithm according to which each of these orange box behaves is a protocol. Okay, so this is a very idealized view of what's going on. So here it is. So you get this then depiction of the various layers of the protocol. Now, this one is a protocol, doesn't have to be, you know, the ISO-OSI protocol. It doesn't have the same hierarchy. It's just simply saying what a protocol must achieve. Then you can break these protocols to different layers of abstraction, from physical to the Mac to the presentation to the whatever algorithmic level and so on. And this is done to break the problem of designing communication protocols, into different layers of abstraction. So And in fact, these are the characterization of protocols has gone a long way to facilitate the design of complex protocols on the network. So, for example, the TCP/IP protocol, the protocol on the internet, can be seen along this line of various layers in which it works. By the way, many of this communication adaptation, all of that, there is something that we have to keep in mind, is that if the resources are limited, so the channel is faulty or whatever, or the mismatch between the input and the output requires us to do a lot of calculation, then what happens is that I cannot, in most of the protocols, I cannot guarantee a particular timing. So the quality of service, QoS, not there. So there are situations in which you can develop things that protocols that have quality of service, but that is a research on itself, and it's very difficult, for example, in internet, to guarantee a particular speed. In fact, you can see it, right? I mean, especially when you are at home, here it's too fast, right? The variations that are there, they're not worthy, but you don't realize that. But when I am at home, for example, I can see that according to different time of the day, it goes like speed of light or it's low, right? So quality of service is not guaranteed. So to guarantee quality of service, you need to develop algorithms that have guaranteed properties, right, in the interconnection and so on. And when they say that they guarantee you performance on your internet at home, and say it's at least so many megabytes, if you look at the at least so many megabytes in the contract, you know, the tiny black thing, it's about one tenth of what they say it goes, right? Not only, but they can they guarantee that? Not even that. Is in average case, right? And that's what you get. That is not, because it's not. It's best effort, it's not quality of service. Best effort is whatever I can do. You know, so turns out that I measure my speed on the line, and you know, 9 times out of 100 it goes at this speed. Okay, then they sell you for that speed. Right? So they cannot guarantee it. Okay, so as a design methodology, you can have functional decomposition. You break down your initial functionality into blocks. Then you do the behavior adaptation between the blocks. Then you insert the communication media. And as I said before, nothing prevents me, if I had a particular decomposition of functionality before, to break it, right? And so the communication media insertion not necessarily goes exactly in the places where the functional decomposition, original functional decomposition advanced. Then I do a communication refinement, I do a channel adaptation, and then I do the mapping and the optimization. So that would be an ideal way of doing design based on the communication scheme that I selected. Right? So I wish we could do that. It's not done, and we suffer for it, but it would be nice to at least know what you're doing. So the functional decomposition, you can imagine that highest abstraction level, a system is a single process. So imagine. So for example, the entire internet is a single process. It just takes inputs that are the content and distributes the input to everywhere. Right? That's the end of story. Boom. One gigantic block. Now, what you can do is that you can take this system and break it down into a set of concurrent processes that have some causality or input-output relationship. You get this. Now, mind you, that there is another thing that we can have at the top level or system level. Remember that I always say that you want to have on one side the functionality, on the other side the architecture, and you should never mix the functionality to the architecture. So, ideally, really ideally, the single block, the single system block, how should it be expressed? Should we use a language like C or, I don't know, make it Modelica, Singuline, or not? Actually, that is already an implementation, isn't it? Right? Because I'm giving a set of sequence of operation. That's what the language does. It is expressing what is happening in terms of single computations, right? Now, so if I want to be free even from that, what should I give as the system? Well, I should just give what it's supposed to do. That's the end of the story, without telling how. And so what is that? It's denotational representation. Denotational representation, it simply says what you expect the block to do, not how it does it. So at the beginning of the class, I made the example in the world of continuous mathematics, and I said that a denotational specification is find x such that f of x is equal to 0. So what I said is that it's just a property that x has to satisfy to be a solution. So I just give a rule to say all the x such that f of x is equal to 0 are a solution. Now, if I wrote down the Newton-Raphson algorithm, I would have computed x such that f of x is equal to 0, but it's not the only way to do it, right? We could use, as I mentioned already, you know, relaxation techniques or whatever other method you want to do, fixed point techniques. And so the point is that if you want to really abstract what you really want, you should give a denotational specification. So that single blob is actually not even an operational description, is a denotational description. So when you operationalize it, you're already choosing an architecture. But it's the architecture of the computation in this particular case. So if I write down the steps of a Newton-Raphson algorithm, not yet written in a computing language, by the way, I just say write down equations, right? So that's already a way of finding x such that f of x equals to this. Then if I take this notation of the Newton-Raphson algorithm and I take it and I break it into pieces, so that, for example, you know that one piece of the Newton-Raphson algorithm is the inversion of a matrix, right? And so I can represent the operation of a Newton-Raphson algorithm as a set of subprocesses. Now, when I say find x such that ax is equal to 0, the description, operational description of the Newton-Raphson algorithm contains blocks that are denotational. Right? So find x such that ax is equal to 0. Now, if I take that and I represent that, I mean, I implement that with LU decomposition, I chose an architecture to compute x such that ax is equal to 0. So you see this repeating into itself, right? So it's a fractal nature of design, as we said before. So, you know, you can imagine this one is a flow diagram of a Newton-Raphson algorithm, and each of these processes is a denotational process that I need to instantiate. And that is a part of the design. So the process is really a relation between an input domain and an output codomain. There is only behavior, there is no communication. The communication is taking place by this arrow that tells you equality, this thing is equal to that. And there are denotational specifications, as we said before. So every time you have a structure to the description of what you want to do, you have an operation. There is no structure, no operation. Right? So in fact, in this particular case, this one is a structural or architectural view of what this system does, but each of these subsystems is still denotation at this point. Then, of course, if I had, for example, already a routine existing in my math library that does ax equal to 0, ax equal to b, I should say, ax equal to b, then by all means I say, well, that's the end of it, because I have an implementation of it, so even the denotational representation becomes automatically into an operational representation. I don't need to go down one level further. So take, for example, a functional decomposition of MPEG decoder. So an MPEG decoder has a number of blocks that do the calculation. So MC is a motion compensation, the IDCT is the inverse direct cosine transform, and VLD beats me, I forgot. Who remembers what the VLD does?
Variable length
decoding. Yes, variable length decoding. Okay. So now this one is a decomposition of the algorithm. So now you have to put in behavior adapters that match different domains so that processes can understand each other. So there are relations between two domains. They are not part of the original system specification, you know, because the original system specification did not have the problem of matching the input and output domains. And then you need independent, you need it independently of how the communications perform. Just because there are two components that have to communicate among themselves, there is the need of communication, independent of how this communication is implemented. So maybe implemented by, maybe it's a bit better, right? Thank you. Maybe it's implemented by, a channel, a wireless channel, maybe is implemented with a wire or whatever. So now, this one is the representation of my VLD, IDCT, MC display and so on. Notice that MC output, the motion compensation output, has blocks of data that are called M blocks, but the display can take only the data in frames. And so what I need to do is I need to organize the output of the MC block into data that the display can understand, okay, or can act on. And that is a behavior adaptation. And so for each of these, you have, for example, vector to block, block to M block, and M block to frame. Okay, so if each of these data transformations, in this particular case it's a format transformation, so the data are packaged in a different form, is achieved by a behavior adapter. So how about communication and model computation then? So the communication medium, it says that each link needs a communication medium, does not affect or change the relation inside the processes. This one is simply saying that I have to implement this wire that I put down, this connection that I put down. An MOC wrapper is used to establishing a particular firing rule and the communication semantics for each of these connections that I am implementing with respect to before. And so, only the wrapper of the MOC is changed if you change the way in which you make these two interact, but not the inside. That's the whole point of using this representation of communication, because you don't want to change the inside when you change the way in which you communicate between two blocks. And I want to stress that. So again, you have these various sub-blocks that do behavior adaptation. Then you insert a particular communication media that connects up the various components. Now, this communication media can be actually, if you implement this block onto a chip, maybe wire, or maybe a bus, or maybe if you implement them in a different physical location, it can be a wire across the wall, or it can be a wireless connection, right? So this where I need to insert the model of the channel. Now, the refinement process is that any communication medium can be refined into arbitrary netlist as long as the interface is not changed. So I can take any of these things and can break it up and have it as rich and as complicated as I like, as long as the model computation and the interfaces are not changed. So the channel adapters are used again to maintain the properties of this interconnect when a medium is inserted. So, for example, I can impose between two blocks a lossless communication, but I have to implement it with a lossy communication channel. If I use, for example, a wireless connection, because we know that wireless is lossy. So the refinement gets into this way. And what you see here is our particular sub-blocks that represent that adaptation, if you like, of the communication. And in fact, this can be considered as being a common bus that interconnects the various blocks through this communication backplane. Okay? And so what I need to do now is the fact that VLD and VA, that before we are communicating like that, where I had this adaptation of communication, is actually taking this structure. Why? Because there is a bus. And so you have the arbitration blocks and you have the segmentation that is needed to write the data on the bus. Right? Now, if I had decided not to use a bus, I would not have this bus, right? And so I would have had a different implementation. But if I do these things of isolation as I said before, notice that I have not changed anything here. They stay absolutely the same. They would stay absolutely the same, which is the name of the game in reusability. Now, there is a mapping and optimization in the sense that once I decide the particular topology that I'm going to use for this interconnect and so on, then I want to be able to find among all the possible architectures and all the possible components that I can find in my bag of tricks, the one that performs best. Now, it may very well be that in order to optimize the overall design, I may go back here and repartition the design because I realize that there is a better way of combining things together that is creating less overhead, for example. And so you map each element onto an architecture, and then you can merge processes, adapters, and media into a single process when it is applicable. And so, and then you provide an imperative description for each process because that's the final implementation. So, even though logically all the pieces are separate, so you got the block, and then you got the adapter, and then you got the channel, and then you got the adapter to the channel. In the end, when you want to optimize, you can smash everything together if you so decide. But the important thing is that you have to maintain the back pointer to what these blocks were coming from, so that if there is an error at some point in the design process, then you can recover where this error has happened. If you don't keep this hierarchy of this success and refinements, then all the best are off. Right? You will never be able to recuperate. So this one is a particular way in which you're going to do. For example, you're going to put together the motion compensation with these two blocks into one, and with appropriate memory so that your system is optimized. Okay? So it's just to give you a view of what communication design is all about if you use the principle of a rigorous design methodology. Right? So you can take anything that you have learned in communication classes and see it this way, because I think it's very, very powerful to prevent from errors, to reuse the various blocks and unify what really communication is, no matter if you do it on chip, off chip, over the internet, over whatever, right? So, okay, I'll see you on Thursday. Then at this point, what we will do is that how you design or how you synthesize the interfaces between different blocks, and you build these adapters automatically. Sì, però stanotte sarò un disastro. Perché beh, mi sono andato, ero cotto completo alle 8. Ah già, scusa.